Don't worry. I'm not gonna do what everyone thinks I'm gonna do. Flip out, man. All I wanna know is who's coming with me? Who's coming, man? Who's coming with me? Huh? Who's coming with me, man?
I will.
Jan. Thank you, Jan. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Bully, man. Jan. Be my girlfriend?
I would. But I'm gay, you know.
Oh.
I'm a big dyke.
What's that like?
And this time we are talking about, well, I'd say one good, which we've already talked about, which would be Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But we're talking about a legendary one, which would be Jerry Maguire. And then we're talking about a more recent one, which is, in my opinion, one of the worst you could watch. More just jokes than it is a movie. Bad Moms. Now, the other options that we were going to have this week, better options on the wheel, were Forgetting Sarah Marshall and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Now,
so this is the first one where we didn't get two of my top three. So Scott Pilgrim versus the World is one of my top three. And then the two that we didn't get would have been how I filled out the rest of the week if I had my choice.
Yeah. And here's the funny thing, because as I mentioned before, my wife put all this together and she's the mastermind behind torturing me more than anybody. Scott Pilgrim versus the World was a rom-com choice. The Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade was the good movie, quote unquote. But if you really try to look at both of these, you can look at both of them as rom-coms until Elsa turns out to be a Nazi, basically, in the Last Crusade. But we are week three. Next week, I'm going to have some hateful shit to say this week, but next week I am going to be very close to just murdering someone on air. Like, I might kill my wife. I might kill myself. I might kill everyone I come in contact with.
We do this remotely so that I am, like, unless you start, you got, like, the ring powers and can reach through my screen.
Right. Yeah, me and Samar are just going to start, like, coming through screens and doing evil shit over the phone. But yeah, next week is the one I'm absolutely dreading. Like, I can put up with the garbage this week, but next week is going to be rough. But before we even get into stuff for this week, we got to talk about what we're drinking. So, Mike, what do you got?
All right, so I've had way too much beer in my fridge, so I got to do a little bit of a fridge clean out week. And since this will be released on Thanksgiving, this is like the culmination of fall. I know fall technically goes into mid-December, but like fall's October, November, and summer September.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, with global warming and whatnot, it's definitely just October, November now.
Yeah. So I decided to try and do one of my abominations to make the ultimate fall flavored beer.
Oh boy.
So I've got apple pie crumb cake pale ale from Westville Brewing. And I've got maple pumpkin pancake brown ale from Bolero Snort Brewery. So we're hitting the pumpkin, we're hitting the apple, we're hitting the maple.
Yep.
And I got the cauldron.
Yeah, you just need like the taste of a flannel shirt or something. You know, whatever that tastes like. Yeah.
You know, it's funny, all the sweet flavors, I think, battled it out, all died, and now it just tastes like regular beer.
The taste of beer has won out. Yeah. The hops proved the strongest.
It's an ale now, and it's like not like one of them's like a cream ale, the other's like a brown ale, so it is now a regular ale.
It's like a cream soda ale. That's funny. Nice. All right. So I, on the other hand, am still working through the last of my Oktoberfest beers. The first one I'll be going through will be a new one. The second one will be a repeat from a while ago. But not technically an Oktoberfest beer. It's just more of a Marzen in general. But this one is from Chamonix Creek. It is their Creekfest Beer Lager, which is a traditional Marzen-style lager. It's 5.2, and the Chamonix Creek's right across the river. And I think it's in Downingtown? No, Croydon is where it is. And in Croydon, PA.
They have a couple tasting rooms, though. Like, I feel like one's in, like, New Hope.
Yeah, I think you're right. But the Chamonix Creek always makes a good beer. Like, I don't think I've ever had one of them that I haven't liked, at least just been like, you know, this is a fun beer, you know, it's a good beer. I've never had one where I'm like, yeah, this is a misfire. You know. But yeah. Creekfest beer, lager. So on to the other quote unquote good stuff, which was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. 2010, a rom-com according to my wife, which you can definitely see is kind of a rom-com. You know, it if is. You really
like,
think
you,
about
you
it.
You have the tropes of like the guy having he has the alternate love interest and then the actual love interest, though it's played way differently than a generic rom-com, because really the only asshole in the trio is the guy.
Right. It's definitely Scott, played by Michael Cera. And yeah, it's that's the thing. I remember talking about this because we talked about this movie for Edgar Wright. And it was a while ago. It was, a couple years ago? And
yeah, I want to say it was maybe either 2 or 3 Februaries ago.
And I think it was, our first February that we had, because we did, a love month, and I think Edgar Wright was one of them.
Yeah, I picked Edgar Wright as the director that I wanted to talk about.
Right, and I remember because that was the first time I'd ever seen this movie, and I'm not a giant Michael Cera fan. I love him on Arrested Development. He's great on that show. I'm fine with him as a small, spice in other in things, but if you're going to make him a star, I'm not really here for it. I hate Juno. I'm not a fan of Michael Cera focused things. And I don't really know why. I'm okay with Superbad, but he's the best part of that because Jonah Hill sucks so much, you know?
I love Superbad. I can't agree with you on that one.
I'm not saying the whole movie's bad. I'm just saying I'm not a fan of Jonah Hill, you know?
Well, yeah, Jonah Hill is like a total dick in that. But I think if you're gonna, as far as starring roles, this is how you gotta have him in a movie, because he's got enough people to play off of that it's like, yeah, he's the star, but really, the entire movie, his roommate's so fucking funny.
Wallace.
Wallace.
Wallace, played by Kieran Culkin, is pretty great. I love the running gag with him, because Anna Kendrick plays Scott's sister, and I love the running gag that no matter what happens, Wallace will somehow have already told Anna Kendrick about it, and she will instantly know these things. I also love the
apparent running gag that Wallace always turns Anna Kendrick's boyfriend's gay.
Right.
We're not talking about Bad Moms yet, but this movie and Bad Moms have a similar theme in that if you're dating Anna Kendrick, you're not looking at anyone else. And if Mila Kunis is looking to get laid, she does not have to look far.
Exactly. Yeah. It's more of a how many dicks do I have to dodge before I catch the one I want, you know?
there's a whole scene in that movie where they're like, no, you don't look sexy enough. I'm like, Mila Kunis could come out in Crocs, a full gray sweatsuit covered in stains, and I would still go for that easily.
She could look like Meg Griffin and she'd still be attractive, you know. It's really tough for that woman to not look too attractive. And it's funny because the same thing with Anna Kendrick, you know, she's a beautiful woman as well. But the funny thing is, in this movie, they're all basically supposed to be like early 20s, but and the gag with Scott Pilgrim is that he's what, 22, I think they say. And he's dating Knives, who is 17, and that's, the joke that, you know, It's funny in the movie because they don't play it. They play it then. Even Scott knows it's wrong. Like that thing. Like he doesn't even want to acknowledge
it. They play it the way that you gotta play it, in that this is like awkwardly funny. Everyone right. knows that you're in the wrong, including you.
Yeah, right. And they don't play it as he's predatory on her. It's more of like she's more of the aggressor in the relationship, which is it's funny enough, is what it is. And the thing is, even though there's a lot of stuff in here where you look at it, you go, okay, so I'm supposed to believe Aubrey Plaza is, you know, like a early 20 something working at a coffee store. Okay, sure. I'm supposed to really think that Anna Kendrick is this age. Yeah, Kieran Culkin, all that. Scott Sarah, Michael Cera looks that young, whatever. Then the unbelievable thing, though, is in this movie that's basically a video game, is that Michael Cera and Anna Kendrick are brother and sister. What are we doing? What are we doing here? The genetics
in that family did not turn out fair.
They definitely split in like an 80-20 sprint. You know?
That's like with Big Bang Theory, where they show Sheldon's twin sister.
Oh, yeah, yeah, where she's like that gorgeous woman, and it's like...
yeah.
But she's like actually like filled out and like proportionate, you know, she's an attractive woman and he's like the skinny fucking rail of like an alien, basically. It's like, well, what the hell happened there? And he's from Texas, so it's like she's like the Texas woman and he's the, I don't know, the science experiment, I guess, from the one science class in Texas they allow.
But this movie, like, I don't believe it did that well when it first came out. And I think it's because of how ahead of its time. Like, I think if this movie came out today, it would be a massive hit. People would say it was like a breath of fresh air on like other movies coming out today.
See, I don't know, man. I want to say that if this came out today, like 2023, November 2023, this is a post The Marvels movie. I'm willing to bet that this movie is completely overlooked, because unless it's like a small indie film that has to grow a cult following, I feel like everyone's going to look at this and be like, oh, it's another comic book adaptation. Oh my God, we're fucking done with these, man. You know, even though Edgar Wright is like proven to be a great director.
Except what I think it would have to go the Into the Spider-Verse route, where everyone's another comic book adaptation. But then people go to see it and they're like, no, this one's different.
This one's the good one. Yeah. And I'm looking at it right now. The budget for this was somewhere between 60 and 85 million, and it only made 49.3 at the box office. So this was a failure by budget to grease standards. But it obviously,
but it's got a huge cult following now.
It's got a huge cult following, yeah. And it's, when you watch it, it's very, I don't know, I want to say it's very Canadian, you know, but it's also very like Edgar Wright. Like, it really is very stylish, and it's a movie where he really got the visuals of a comic book and a video game like on screen, and he made it work. Where this, I would outright call the best video game adaptation, simply because it's a video game movie. Like, it's literally a movie that looks like a video game, you know, even though it's not
crazy the people they got to be in this.
Right. Yeah. And it's all, this is 2010. So this is pre
Anna Kendrick. Like, she already did Twilight, but she wasn't full blown star Anna Kendrick with this.
Yeah. This is pre
Pitch Plaza hadn't, like, when did Parks and Rec start?
Probably shortly after this, I think.
But so then she's not really like Aubrey Plaza yet. Then you get the real big hitters with like Chris Evans, and you get Todd is one of the Supermans. I forget which one.
Brandon Routh. He's Superman Returns.
Okay.
He's the what's his name? It's the fucking rapist one. The director that was the gay rapist, did the X-Men movies. What was it? And it's also got Spacey in it too. Bryan Singer is who I'm thinking of. He's the creepy, molesty, touchy-feely guy. And
you get Brie Larson as the scorned, well, I guess she's They play Scorner. It weird in the movie because like, she's Envy Adams, but it's like apparently they broke up just because she moved away. But now it's like, but there's clearly something more to that in the movie.
Yeah. And this is with Chris Evans, this is a year before Captain America comes out. So this is before his skyrocketing to fame, and this would become like Matt Damon in Euro Trip kind of a thing, yeah, or whatever it is. That would be like the equivalent of what that would become for Chris if this was a post Captain America world for Chris Evans. But instead it's a post Fantastic Four world for him, so no one cares, you know? And then of course there's, you know, Jason Schwartzman, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's Jason Schwartzman. And
yeah, it's literally the perfect role for him.
Oh, I mean, well, it's the role that he always plays. That's the thing. He always plays that like smarmy asshole. But then there's Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who, and of course, this is where the frame, it's not this one specifically, because it was like Elizabethtown or something, or Garden State. The Manic Pixie Dream Girl is where that phrase came from, that Nathan Rabin created. And then almost immediately walked back because everybody kind of pointed out that it's a stupid phrase. And his reasoning behind coming up with it was kind of sexist. But I don't quite subscribe to that, because I don't think a lot of people understood really what he meant by it. Like, he wasn't saying that it was... He wasn't saying it was good. He was saying it's a thing. It's a bad trope in movies that are only self-serving to male characters, and that's a problem, is what he was saying. But everyone was kind of like missing that, because no one has the sense to go that next level anymore. They just read brief description and go, "Oh, that's serving a man's purpose. Well, that's bad." It's like, well, kind of why you brought it up, you know.
You know what? Totally opposite with Manic Pixie Dream Bro, like Sam Rockwell in the Way Way Back, where everyone should want a friend like that in their lives.
Right, exactly. And then I saw recently, I think it was after like Wednesday came out, the Netflix show, someone like turned it into the Manic Pixie Mean Girl, where it was just like the girl that's just angry all the time, you know? and it's like Wednesday, and it's like Aubrey Plaza, and you know, a couple other ones that I can't remember, but they did kind of like turn it around. It's like, well, yeah, but you're still using a stupid phrase to explain a very simple thing, which is a hack character trait. This one just has the twist of Scott may be, she is out of step. Ramona Flowers is out of Scott's league, and he is chasing after her, but he also has to fight her exes to get to her, which is, it's not great in the sense that Ramona has her own independence and is a character. It's more self-serving for Scott to attain the girl, which is, he's literally doing, he's literally fighting his way to her. And it's bad in that sense, but in the sense that it's never been shown before. Like, it's never been shown that you have to literally work through this girl's past to be able to be with her in the future, you know, in the present day. And you have to come to terms with, accept this stuff, you know, first.
So my favorite video game trope that they actually break down in this movie is, like, the main character versus his shadow self. The Mega Scott. Which, it's like, every time this doppelganger thing shows up in a video game or a TV show, it's always like, oh, they're the opposite of each other. One's totally good, one's totally evil. And I love this because Scott is totally neutral, like, slight asshole. So his Nega Scott is not going to be very different from him.
Nope. And I love how they just come out talking.
Yeah.
He's like, no, he's a great guy. We're going to get together. You're expecting this big bloody fight news come out talking. It's pretty funny.
This movie's so great because Edgar Wright's, like, some of the lines in this movie are just so, like, nonchalantly played that I love it. Like, he's like, when I'm around you, it's like I'm on drugs. Not that I do drugs. Unless you do drugs. Then I do them all the time. All of them.
All of them. Yeah, and then, I mean, there's a couple...
When Knives asks young Neil, what do you play? He's like, oh, I play Zelda, Tetris. That's a big question.
Right. Yeah, all she really means is bass.
Yeah.
For whatever he plays. But what I like is, there's a couple of good ones. And it's the first time I think that Scott is talking to Anna Kendrick, and he goes, "Who told you?" And she goes, "Wallace, duh." And he goes, "That gossipy bitch." Then there's another one, and it's, oh, okay, yeah, me and Kim, meaning Allison Pill's character, me and Kim are all good now. And it cuts to Allison Pill, and she is just staring daggers through his, like, heart. She just had to look at her face like she's gonna murder him.
Everyone looks at Aubrey Plaza as, like, the iconic mean girl in this movie. Kim is way better.
Allison Pill is pretty great. I mean, I think, I mean, I have the strong belief that, and Aubrey Plaza can contact us and fight this as much as she wants, but I have a strong belief that Aubrey Plaza's, like, psycho mean girl, or, like, just doesn't give a shit, disaffected mean girl, like, character, I think it's just an act. I think it's kind of like, it's like
she started playing a character, she got a lot of attention and love for it, and just kind of rolled with it as a marketing thing.
Yeah, she kept it and rolled it into career for her. But I feel like you can't do that unless you're a good actress, you know? You can't just be that and people still want to work with you, you know? At a certain point, everyone's got to stop having the self-loathing to work with, like, a person who literally is just miserable and hates them. But would have to, like, the real Anna would, I mean, the real Aubrey would have to come through. And she's good for staying in character. She's like a professional wrestler that just stays in character the whole time, you know? She's really good at not breaking kayfabe, you know? But then there's, again, like I said, the running gag of everything basically involving Wallace. Just all of his running gags, just his, like, character.
Oh, where he's, like, having sex and Scott's just sitting next to them in bed complaining about stuff.
When everybody, like, when that one scene where Scott sits up, Wallace sits up, the other dude sits up, and then a third guy sits up.
Wallace is the best. I fucking love him.
Yeah, and it's all, like, the small, like, queen size at best air mattress on the floor. There's four dudes just kind of in this bed, three of which are having sex.
I forgot, my favorite delivery in this movie does come from Michael Cera. It's when he goes back to Ramona's place and she's listing off all the, she's like, "What kind of tea do you want? Like, there's more than one kind," and she starts listing them off and he just goes, "Did you make some of them up?"
It sounds like you made some of those up, yeah. And then she ends with Earl Grey. Yeah, and then, oh man, I forget who says it or what it's about, but I want to have his adopted babies. Like, for why that line happens, but I wrote it down because I remember it made me laugh. But then there's one of the boyfriends, one of the in the league of exes, evil exes. One of the boyfriends ends up being like a Bollywood routine. And yes, I believe the actor is an Indian gentleman, but I was, like, watching, like, is this racist or just dumb? Like, I think this is a step too far. You know, you rein this back in. I don't think in 2010 we're ready for a Bollywood reference, you know? And now they're played out, but it's like, okay. Now,
I will say the funniest part of that fight is when he's like, "Didn't you get my email?"
Like, genuinely, did you not get my email? Because we do hear Scott reading the email before and he just kind of dismisses it.
The way he says it, it's almost like if the email failed to deliver, he would have left and given Scott, like, time to cope with what was going on and then fought later.
He would have resent it and, like, let him actually read it and see what's going on, yeah. But, and then, of course, there's, you know, Chris Evans's role is great. Chris Evans as whatever his movie star is, that's, like, it's funny when Scott has to, like, fight his stunt doubles when there's, like, six of them.
Getting his ego and, like, trying to get him to grind down
a super ass long, like, stairway railing. Yeah, that was funny. Hold on. I do like when he's like, "Oh, wait, you didn't know about the exes? Oh, man, I'm sorry." And, like, goes to, like, literally give him a hand to, like, get up and he just punches him in the face.
Ooh. When Knives Out came out, we're like, "Wow, Chris Evans is a great villain." I was like, "I know, I watched Scott Pilgrim."
Exactly, yeah, you've seen it. You know, he's just a funny actor. He's a funny dude. And, what I thought was even funnier is because Brandon Routh's character is an ex-girlfriend of Ramona Flowers, but is currently the bass player for Brie Larson's band, which is
the Clash at Demonhead.
Clash at Demonhead, that's what it's called. And
oh, by the way, music in this movie, awesome.
The music is pretty great. Yeah, it is. And the thing is, though, with Brandon Routh's character, he's vegan, and he uses his, like, vegan powers against Scott, but then there's, like, the list of things that, like, he drinks the coffee with the real milk in it, yeah. And that brings the vegan police, played by Thomas Jane and Clifton Collins.
Now, there are two lines in this movie that are so over-the-top cheesy that I actually love them both, which one is, "You were a vegan, but now you will be gone."
Be gone, yeah.
The second comes with one of my favorite tropes in the movie, where Scott keeps saying seven evil ex-boyfriends, and Ramona keeps correcting them, exes.
Exes, yeah, because one of them is a girl.
One of them and the line I'm talking about with her is, she's like, "I was a little bi-curious," and then she goes, "Well, I'm a little bi-curious."
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's like, okay. This wouldn't work.
To kill her by making her orgasm to death.
That is correct. Yes, that is, she is touched on the back of the knee, which apparently is an erogenous zone for her, and she orgasms to death. And it's it's Mae Whitman or her for the rest of development, and it's funny because all of this stuff you're like, this could be stupid, this could be dumb, but it's like, it's done with such, like, care and creativity that you're like, just the devotion to actually making this a good adaptation of the comic book makes it even better, you know? You're like, okay, this is, a lot of this could be stupid, but I'm going with it because of the care put into making it, you know?
Yeah, they set the tone right, they make it, like, they stylize the movie to a point where you're like, okay, this is that universe. Let's roll with it.
Yeah, it's pretty great. And what I do really love is the other running gag of Scott's hair, being that he cut his own hair because he gave himself a bad haircut, and then Brie Larson broke up with him, so it's never been the same since. And the funny part is that it's such a great running gag, but really is a terrible fucking hair.
Yeah.
It's like, they're like legitimately making fun of Michael Cera's hair, and it's pretty great. It's almost like Edgar Wright saw his hair and was like, you know what? I'm going to turn this into a joke. Can't abide by this shit, man.
And then you get to the fifth and sixth evil exes, which are easily, they're like the least memorable by far.
You mean the DJs?
Yeah.
That is just like, it's like the fight in Kung Fu Hustle between the two, like, assassins and the three, like, people in the apartment complex, whatever. Yeah. Where they're playing the music and sending out the, like, the punches or whatever.
Which also, like, if that was a battle of the bands, why the fuck are there DJs there? Or right. If that's, like, a DJ, why the fuck is there a band there?
Right. Yeah, pick one. You gotta pick one. Unless these guys are the backing DJs for a band, then it doesn't make any sense. It's just dumb.
Which, in the thing of the story, no. Apparently, they're very big-name DJs.
I guess, yeah. But, and then, of course, Jason Schwartzman's the last one. And, yeah, it's... Again, I remember the first time watching this being like, all right, fucking Michael Cera. But now, like, watching it again, like, you know what's coming. You can really focus more on, like, the good running gags that are going through it. Like, we didn't even mention my favorite gag is when Ramona shows up at, is it Ramona or not? Shows up at his little, like, at his door, and Wallace opens the door, and you see Scott dive out the window in the background. And he reaches back in for his coat.
I also love Anna Kendrick at the show, like, just introducing them to each other.
Oh, even that was it. That was the other thing. The other great thing that got me laughing was the Anna Kendrick sight gag. When he's talking to Anna Kendrick, Scott's talking to Anna Kendrick at the coffee, like, counter. He blinks, and it's Aubrey Plaza, and he turns, and Anna Kendrick's, like, outside, and she's like, "I gotta go, bye!" And she just kind of walks away, because, again, the running gag that is that she never actually wants to talk to Scott.
Yeah.
And she just wants to tell him that she knows his, like, secret that Wallace told him. She's like, "I gotta go, bye!"
That's probably about all I have to say on Scott Pilgrim. Like, the ending fight's cool, but really,
it's fine.
I mean, like, the whole, you got the power of love. You got the power of self-respect.
Well, you know who the announcer for that is, right?
Was that
Bill Hader?
Yeah,
Bill Hader. Yeah. Scott from the Sword of Truth, the self enlightenment. But yeah, so you know, it's that's Scott Pilgrim. That is a rom com, according to my wife. We got
I'm
that
glad
one.
It's a rom com because it's my favorite of the official rom com so far.
It is. It is a good one, and that makes this week the only one that we didn't get the quote unquote good movie to go with it. These are three chosen by my wife rom coms, so this is the true rom com roulette, and we lost this week, Mike. All three bullets of rom coms. So, Mike, how is your Frankenstein abomination beer?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I don't know if this is worthy of me signing off on collaboration and reaching out to the two breweries. I have a lot of pull in getting collaborations done now, but
every
I don't know
previous
if I'm
one you've
that,
done,
but
yeah, every one previous one you've done has been made.
Every previous one I've done that I endorse has been made because I've
that
done
is
some
true.
Pretty bad ones.
That is true. That is true. Yeah, the ones we've given the okay to have gotten made.
No, I mean, this tastes fine, but it's like, I could have just poured a slightly sweet ale, and I think it might taste the same.
Probably. Yeah, that'd be funny if you go to one of these, like, breweries that you have given your endorsement on the collaboration. You walk in, they're like, Mike, what are you doing here? And they're like, racing aboard, you know? The Mike collaboration beer suddenly disappears.
Oh, no. I would if I walked in and found out that I inspired a collaboration, I would be so happy.
No, he's gonna sue us. It's like, no, Ross is the litigious one. Still locked up in litigation with Ross Brewing. It's fine. But yeah. Manischewitz Creek. Creek Fest be a lager. It's the traditional Mosel style lager for Oktoberfest. It's very good. Very good. So, on to Jerry Maguire, which is 1996. Now, this is a legendary rom-com. It has two legendary all-time rom-com lines in it. Well, yeah, that's the third iconic line from the movie. But I'm more talking about You Had Me at Hello and what the hell is the other one? You Complete Me. That's what it is. Yeah, You Complete Me. I'm going to say this right off the bat. And you people can send your hate mail to Happy Hour Films on Facebook or Instagram. I don't care where you do it because I don't really care. Hate this movie. Fucking hate this movie. I am not a fan of it. I absolutely despise it. While at the same time, I am a Tom Cruise fan. I enjoy the man. I just prefer Tom Cruise, the action star. This is Tom Cruise, the rom-com star, but somehow still, this entire movie is like jerking off Tom Cruise's ego the whole movie. That's all it's
doing. Even though we get a lot of funny Tom Cruise run.
Yeah, there is a Tom Cruise run in this, which is insane because it's a fucking rom-com. Like, where are you running to? All right, he's running to the girl. That's what he's doing. And okay. But right off the bat, this is another movie where it's like, oh my God, we have a ton of people in here that I completely forgot were in this movie. Because last time I saw this was probably in early 2000s, late 90s for in high school.
But why is Jay Mohr typecast into a protege who somehow scorns the guy who like taught him?
I would take it a little more broad and just say that he's typecast as an asshole because he's usually an asshole, like in most things.
But I'm like, so this is the second time I saw him specifically in the role of protege that scorns the guy who, like, kind of.
What was the other movie?
It's actually Scrubs. He plays Dr. Petey, who fucked. He was with Dr. Cox's protege and fucked his wife, and that's why they got divorced.
Oh, yeah. Shit, that's a good fucking pull, Mike.
I'm a huge Scrubs fan. As soon as I turn this on, I'm like, this is the first time I actually watched Jerry Maguire. And I'm like, this is only the second time I've seen this guy in a role where he fucks over the guy who like took him under his wing. But that's like, it's weird that it happened twice.
And it is weird that in this one he doesn't actually fuck anybody to do it. You know, this one he's just, it's a professional fucking is what it is. But yeah, it's like, oh wow, yeah, deep. Mike's Mike the scrub super fan pulling the deep cut out. Bill Lawrence would be proud of you, man. He probably forgot that.
I fucking but, love Scrubs, especially the early seasons.
The thing is, though, if you go back and like watch that show, there is so much of it that does not hold up to that.
Really, I'm willing like, to all... put on my rose-colored glasses and ignore it.
I was gonna say, like the entire, like JD's entire existence doesn't really hold up. But Dr. Cox still iconic.
Dr. Cox is in my top five television show characters ever.
Yeah, he's still iconic, but yeah. But then this one, of course, this one's also directed by Cameron Crowe, who also did Almost Famous, was a Rolling Stone journalist, all this stuff. So that's why the music in this movie is good. It was legitimately good, but it's also like it's one of those like serious XM radio like deep cut channels. Like, there are a lot of songs in here that you know, but they're not the hits from the band that are they're playing them. Now, here is the deep cut trivia in this movie, Mike. What song is Jerry O'Connell singing when he's strumming his guitar when Jerry Maguire goes to talk to him and his dad, Bill Bridges, he goes to talk to his dad at their house?
I couldn't tell you.
He's singing Something in the Way by Nirvana. Huh. Which, if anyone knows, was very made very famous again in The Batman at the beginning of this year.
And is it wrong that every time I see Jerry O'Connell, all I can think of is the Family Guy Stephen King episode? Where they're like, it's true, the fat kid from Stand By Me went on to marry.
Doesn't that piss you off? Well, Richard Dreyfuss. But yeah, Jerry O'Connell's this. Then there's just the funniest part about this movie to me is, of course, if we're watching this in 1996, we are seeing the biggest sports, mostly football athletes in the world at the time. We got our Drew Bledsoes. We got our Troy Aikmans. We got a couple other dudes that you're like, oh, those guys were stars at the time. Watching this in 2023 and knowing the future of all of those actors, of all those athletes, because they are long retired by now. Troy Aikman has been a broadcaster longer than most kids today have been alive. So they don't even know him as a quarterback. But the thing is, seeing all these characters in there, I was like, so Jerry had all of these clients, like Drew Bledsoe and all these other people. None of them had very long careers. Like Drew Bledsoe was around for a while, but I don't believe he's a Hall of Famer.
No, he's not, but he was like I wouldn't say he was like a 12-year starter or something.
He was, but what quarterback that backed him up do people remember more?
Tom Brady, of course.
Young man named Tom Brady. It's like, oh, Drew Bledsoe. I remember that guy. Then it's like it's like Troy Aikman. Oh, the announcer? Well, yeah, but he also won 4 Super Bowls.
So we also got to talk about this because they go into Rod Tidwell's stats. And apparently last season, he had 110 receptions for over 1,500 yards in the 90s.
That's a lot.
In the 90s.
But did you also catch the fact that they say he's too short, which means he's basically Tyreek Hill? Like, this man's catching the ball and running. That's all he's doing, and you are not catching him. All we see him doing this movie is get tackled.
Like, you look at the, like, in 1996, what receivers are in the league putting up those types of numbers? Like, I'm not sure, like any of the big Cowboys receivers from Michael Irvin. I'm not sure Michael Irvin put up those numbers in a single season.
Well, there is one guy who probably did, and it's Jerry Rice.
Well, yeah, Jerry Rice. But I'm like,
which I think that's who they're like directly comparing him to. You know, they're basically saying he's like the Jerry Rice type.
Which, again, you would. So he's upset with his contract and the fact that he doesn't have much in the way of product endorsements. Dude, 110 yards and 1,500 receptions with his personality? So that's the other thing. Like, they show him talking to the media, and he's like telling them, like, nothing in this movie suggests that he is that type of guy. Everything says that, like, he won't shut up. Is like the biggest problem.
He is essentially the Antonio Brown 1996. The only problem is he doesn't lose his mind completely. His concussion, which, let's put it this way, is a severe brain trauma that he has in that Monday Night Football game. You can't be unconscious that long and get up and just fucking dance and jump around. You are getting up and, you know, and be like positive about it. You're getting up like Antonio Brown did when he ripped his shirt off and ran around the fucking Meadowlands or wherever the hell it was that he lost his goddamn mind. That's what Rod Tidwell's doing. But
this movie does look at, like, oh, the health of athletes. That's what kind of starts it is. Tom Cruise puts out a memo that we should be more concerned about the well-being of our clients. And apparently his bosses were like, well, we got to fucking fire him for that.
And that's the thing. This movie is, we're supposed to look at this movie like Jerry Maguire becomes a good man by the end and has morals and decency and all that kind of shit. And then learns to love and be a human. When in reality, he's really just Drew Rosenhaus or Scott Boras, who got caught, like nowadays, who got caught making a shitty tweet public or like a DM got made public. And now they kind of got to fire him for publicity reasons. You know, that's kind of what it is. And sports agents are notorious snakes. That's what they are. They are snakes. They are only out for money. They could give a fuck about their client. They just want the biggest deal for their client, regardless of what that will do to the team or like the team's bankroll or payroll, or if it will,
or even what it'll do to the client. Like, a lot of agents have given clients bad advice that lost them tens of millions of dollars.
Absolutely. And the thing with Jerry, though, is he goes to, and it's funny as hell because this whole sequence cracks me the fuck up, and it's not supposed to. It's supposed to be heartwarming and like kind of heart wrenching. There is a hockey player that Jerry represents, played by Toby Huss, for one. The I got peanut butter on my penis guy from the Halloween 2018 one. He is in Reno 911. He's a very funny comedic actor. He's a hockey player who gets a concussion and basically has to try to remember everything going on. Now he's in the hospital, and this is like the fourth concussion that this guy's gotten, and his career is now in jeopardy. His son, played by Drake Bell, goes out to talk to Jerry in the Jerry Maguire in the hallway, and he turns around and he basically says to Jerry, he says, like, it's my dad. What's going on? Happened to my dad? Blah, blah. And Jerry gives him this speech like, your dad's the toughest, blah, blah, blah. And it's just this bullshit agent talk. And the kid looks at him. He just takes a second. He goes, fuck you. Yeah. And then he goes away. He gives him the finger and he walks off. And that's kind of what sets Jerry into this like nervous breakdown, basically, where he realizes that he's a fraud and making money off of the pain and suffering of athletes, basically, whatever that happens to them. And then manifesto. Look at the time frame.
The dad could have been Pat LaFontaine.
Given the other actual athletes playing, he could have been Troy Aikman. That man suffered 8 concussions. which in speaking of that, there is obviously the legendary line from this, or one of the more legendary sequences, is when Jonathan Lipnicki, a precocious little child actor who we absolutely loved in 1996 and forgot the fuck after that. But he says to Jerry, he says, did you know the human head weighs 8 pounds and all that kind of, like, his little kid facts. Jerry responds by rattling off stats. What he should have rattled off was, did you know Troy Aikman's brain has suffered 8 concussions? You know? And then the kid just named something else. Did you know dogs can smell fear and bees or whatever? It's like, well, did you know that if Jerry Rice was stung by bees, he would die? Or just kind of like make these like relatable stats to this kid. But it's so funny because that is what gets Jerry to like his come to Jesus moment and his like realization that what I'm doing is, it's just scumbaggy. I'm just a scumbag. But then 2 seconds after his manifesto is published, where he's saying we got to be closer in personal relationships, we got to care about our clients, all that stuff, He sent somehow gets it published like overnight because that was the 90s, I guess. And he gets it published overnight, gets it distributed. And every other sports agent in the world basically sees this, or every, at least everyone in his agency sees this. And they're all essentially sarcastically clapping. They're like, yeah, man, great job. You shot yourself in the dick and you're going to be fired because that ain't the business, bro. And they might say that now because it's the cool thing to say. It's like, I'm about people. I care about my clients. Now, no. Scott Boras, Drew Rosenhaus, these dudes don't give a flying fuck about their clients' well-being. All they care about is if they can be healthy enough to sign the biggest contract possible, and then it's the rest is on them. Fuck the team that signed them. Fuck the player. They got their money. I got my bonus. I got my commission. I'm going to move on to the next best thing. And that's why I can't tell who it is. Probably Rosenhaus or Boras, one of the two. They're the only ones that actually manage anybody nowadays. Whoever has Shohei Ohtani's agent is doing that right now. He is making sure that he can hit next year, even though we all know his arm, he can't pitch. He's getting UCL surgery. He's not going to be pitching. That agent right now is discussing with teams. He will be the best designated hitter you've ever had in the history of your franchise. But his pitching, it'll come back. It'll definitely come back. Oh, he'll definitely be the same Shohei Ohtani when he comes back. Sign this $900 million forever contract and take him off my hands. That's what's happening right now, and that's what Jerry Maguire is. I don't give a fuck if he had her at hello.
And which, before we actually get to the rom-com part of this, the other part of this movie that's terrible is Jerry O'Connell's dad, where he's like, you're gonna be the first overall pick in the draft. You don't believe in contracts, you dumb motherfucker.
You're an idiot. You know, also, let's talk about this. Even though it is 1996, the two teams that are fighting for Jerry O'Connell, this high school Texas quarterback, I believe it is, are the Broncos and the Chargers. Now, the Broncos at the time in 1996, I believe, firmly had a starter in the name of John Elway. I don't think they needed a new quarterback to draft number one. They
I can confirm the Chargers needed someone at this point.
They absolutely needed someone. I think they were in their Ryan Leaf phase at that point, maybe.
Leaf was drafted in 96. Yeah, wasn't it?
So it would have been
the Manning draft, I think.
Yeah, it would have been Jerry O'Connell instead of Ryan Leaf. The Chargers may have been a changed franchise after that.
Well, Jerry O'Connell would have been the Peyton Manning because it would have been the Chargers and the Colts competing for the number one pick.
True. But yeah. And then it's,
and the Chargers still get Ryan Leaf because if there's a God, he hates the Chargers. I've never been more upset with myself than picking the Chargers as my favorite football team in the third grade.
It's like that meme, boys will turn four and make one of the following their entire personality for the rest of their life. It's like football, dinosaurs, cars, and like spaceships. But like it was the Chargers, you know, whatever, everything else. But, and okay, so with the actual, you know, rom-com nature of this movie, Renee Zellweger, single mother of a dead, she's a widow. I believe the father is dead.
I think so.
Yeah, he's not.
And then her boss comes on to her. Oh, it's Tom Cruise, so it's okay.
Who she's already in love with because she's a stalker, essentially. And now, when these two crazy kids get together, it's the very, and it's even mentioned, it's the very definition of a Clarence Thomas situation. You know, it's definitely ripe for a sexual harassment lawsuit. Workplace misconduct, all this stuff. Like, it's definitely a problem that these two are going to eventually date. But then again, he's at rock bottom, so he might as well at least try to get laid while he's at it before he kills himself. And she is a horny single mother who is working for Tom Cruise in 1996, so she might as well, you know, get him a step stool so she can, you know, at least kiss him standing on flat feet. But she, Renee Zellweger, again, 1996, also a very attractive woman. They're not exactly hard up for trying to get laid. I mean, Jerry is engaged when we meet her him to Kelly Preston. Rest in peace, Kelly Preston. But in 1996, Kelly Preston is a fucking stone cold smoke show. And she may be psychotic. She may be out of her mind. But the sex is wild because that's how we're introduced to her. And she is definitely a career woman, so she's going to be loaded as well. So if he stays with her and doesn't fuck all this up, he's at least got her financial stability to lean on until he gets his solo agency back on its feet. And because this is a rom-com, she has to be an uber bitch. And he has to dump her, realize that she's a bad person, and then go for the good person in the world, which is apparently Renee Zellweger. Sister of Bonnie Hunt.
About Bonnie Hunt, she's fucking awesome. She's the best part of this movie.
I was gonna say, sister of Bonnie Hunt. Now, you say she's the best part of this movie. She is awesome. I will give her that. But she starts off as one of my least favorite tropes in the history of movies, especially rom-coms, and it is the disapproving bitch sister. That's the role she plays in this. But then, because it's Tom Cruise in 1996 and this entire movie is just jerking Tom Cruise's ego off, she gets a look at him and is essentially just flooded. She falls down, I think, because she slips in a puddle of her own cum. And then she's like, you know what? Yeah, we're going to do everything possible to make sure that you can catch that tiny man's dick. And I'm not going to be a crazy woman because I don't have a room full of divorced women complaining about why men suck in my living room out there. I am going to look at them and be like, you know what? I can look past that to the very tiny man over there with the 400 megawatt smile. And I am going to do everything I possibly can to both support you trying to catch his dick, yet also trying to keep you grounded from not being under the spell of the penis, you know? It's a very weird dichotomy that she walks, but Bonnie Hunt, because she's a talented comedic actress, plays it well. I will give her that credit. She does play that well. But then, if you want to talk about the other women in this movie, then there's Regina King, a phenomenal actress, one of the best there is out there. She's done her best work playing two cartoon children in the Boondocks. But Regina King is a great actress. She plays Rod Tidwell's pregnant wife. And she plays the stereotypical crazy pregnant woman on in entertainment well. But she also gets very emotional at one point when Rod gets injured on Monday Night Football. You can see the actress in Regina King come out. It's amazing. She does a great job. And at no point am I looking at her character and being like, this is contrived horseshit. He's like a legitimate, in pain, scared mother and like wife who's about to possibly watch her entire future become completely uncertain. And then everything works out for her because, of course, it does. But she's not our main love interest here. Because, again, this is the 90s, and Tom Cruise or Regina King would have been a problem. But Renee Zellweger's character, on the other hand, is a legit stalker the entire time. And the only time I actually enjoy her character when we get the Jerry quitting and leaving SMI scene where I'm not going to do what everybody thinks I'm going to do and flip out. Played much better by Jim Brewer and Half-Baked. But anyway, it's the entire movie of this. It's just so formulaic and so contrived. And because I'm dead inside, it just makes me want to grind my teeth and kill myself.
Well, like, that's hard to say on Jerry Maguire. First viewing, I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it.
That's, and most of my hatred for this movie stems from the fact that being 14 in 1996 when this movie came out, well aware of pop culture, well aware of people quoting pop culture and all that. So when "show me the money" became the phrase, everyone said it. And I'm talking everyone on earth said it. 6 billion people, like Jerry says in the beginning of this movie, said the phrase, "show me the money," in whatever context they possibly could. It's like the early 2000s when Chappelle Show quotes were just used in every possible situation. You know, it's awful. the scene plays very weirdly nowadays because you're like, well, why the fuck is Jerry Johnson jumping through these hoops for Rod fucking Tidwell? Rod Tidwell is not the catch he thinks he is. But it's just very uncomfortable to say, he's like, I love black people. And it's like, well, I get that Rod is purposely making him say this shit because he's like, dude, you're my puppet. I can make you do whatever because you're at your lowest point in your life. So I get why Rod would make him do that. It's funny to Rod. But to have him screaming, show me the money for a good 25 minutes, it feels like, it's overkill. Come on, Cameron, you got to cut at some point, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's movie. Yeah, just okay. Like, I get to an extent why it's legendary, but it's okay.
It's, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's, there are, like I said, the lesser known people in this movie, there are some great, like, oh shit, that's that person. Like, I believe she's a gymnast or an archer. I forget what she is. The blonde girl that Jerry calls, one of his clients, and she's like, oh my, Jerry, and she's like crying, but then the other line clicks on, and it's Bob Sugar, and she just goes right back to being normal because it was all a fucking lie. But it turns out it was just Jerry again on the other line, and she's like, oh my god. The girl that plays that character is named, the actress is Angela Gothel. She is the les incompetentes sister from Home Alone. So I was like, yeah, I saw that. I was like, all I can hear is Jerry. You know what the French call les incompetents? But then, you know, it's, I don't know. There's then everything with Jonathan Lipnick. The fact that we took this little child actor and we didn't even have the decency to make him a Haley Joel Osment or a Macaulay Culkin. You know, we just kind of gave him this movie and said, fuck off, dude. You know, we don't care anymore. Go be one of those situations where 20 years from now everyone goes, holy shit, did you see the kid from Jerry Maguire nowadays? You know, it's just annoying. And it's the worst part is Rod Tidwell's entire argument for wanting his gigantic massive trade at the end of his career, basically. He's looking for a $10 million contract at the end of a career for a receiver in the NFL. Not going to happen. I'm sorry. But because of the movie, he gets it. But his argument is, how will my family live after my playing career is over? I'm sorry, Rod. You know what the biggest, most high-paying job any ex-athlete can have? Going from the field to the fucking broadcasting booth, my friend. Just do the Troy Aikman and become more famous as a commentator than you were as a player.
Do the Tony Romo.
Yes, exactly. Like that too. Be a mediocre fucking player and somehow become legendary and make tons of money, endorsements and all that. Because I think Tony Romo still does Corona commercials and Skechers commercials, I think.
Yeah, so, and he had, until Tom Brady's like promised contract, Romo had the biggest broadcasting contract.
And that's the thing. Tony Romo has that, like, I'm a bit of a doofus, but I'm like a hometown doofus kind of guy. He's got that weird appeal, but then it's like, he's got that abrasive, like, personality too, where you're like, there's something not right about this. There's something off about this fake motherfucker. The thing, though, is Tom Brady can be very funny. I just think he needs to be, like, more natural. So if they put him in a booth, I think we get like an intelligent version of Gronk. Like, I think that's what we might get here, which will be crazy. And it will be a non-concussed version of Troy Aikman with more rings and more success to back up his like his player resume. Because like, if we could do this to Tom Brady, I think A, it'll be the best because Tom Brady haters will be so much more mad. And they're my favorite people to pay attention to because they're just completely insane.
Well, it's hilarious because, like, I feel like one picture turned so many people around on Tom Brady. And it was him drunk off his ass with the, what's it called? It was avocado tequila, avocado vodka or something.
Yeah, it was something weird. Yeah,
it was at the Super Bowl celebration after. Yeah.
There was something very Tom Brady to do. It was an alcohol use drunk shit, but it was still like a TB12 approved, tequila or some shit. But, and it's like, okay. But then with this movie, there's the three main catchphrases that are just fucking cancerous to our pop culture. But then there's the one that Cameron Crowe himself was hoping would actually make it as the catchphrase. And that's Swan. It's when Rod Tidwell tries to explain what Swan is. And he's like, oh, it's this. And it's just Swan. And it's like, the only thing I could think of was Mean Girls. I was like, it's Fetch is what it is. He's trying to make Fetch happen and it ain't going to happen. It's like, but what the fuck is Quan? Like, no one cares about Quan in a movie that has show me the money, you complete me, and you had me at hello, and the human head weighs 8 pounds. No one gives a shit about Quan or whatever the hell that is, But even though, again, like, I hate this movie and I hate Tom Cruise as a rom-com actor, the final speech where he does do the you complete me speech in front of the room of divorce.
He did nothing to redeem himself on that romantic front.
Absolutely nothing. But because he's Tom Cruise, when he gives that speech, you're like, oh, God damn it. This guy, I can't stay mad at this guy. I can't stay mad at this alien worshiping motherfucker. I just can't do it. And thinking, you shouldn't either, Renee. And neither should you dried up husks of women. You should all be happy to be near him too. But anyway, we still have another movie to talk about, so that's enough about Jerry Maguire. So Mike, how is your beer?
It's all right. Again, I don't think these flavors complemented each other quite like I was. Actually, my expectations were a little low. There's a lot of flavors in this, but I was hoping for the ultimate fall beer, the turducken of beer, if you will. I did not receive that.
The late great John Madden would approve, but I'm not actually shocked he wasn't in this movie. But I guess he was too busy doing the Waterboy, I think. I think he was doing the Waterboy around the time. But my Neshaminy Creek Creekfest Bier Lager is delicious. And yes, you have to say that with a German accent whenever you talk about Oktoberfest beers. And so now I've moved on to my Cape May Lager, a long liner, which is a crisp, snappy, balanced. And it's a it is a lager, which is what a Marzen usually is. And the best to pair this with are brats, pretzels, and turkey leg. So, as far as I can tell, this is an Oktoberfest beer without the Oktoberfest slap on the label. So,
all right.
Doesn't quite taste like a Marzen lager, but tastes more just like a regular lager. But it's still good because, dang, Cape May Brewing, also very good. On to our final rom-com of the night. It is The Unfortunate Bad Moms from 2016, directed by John Lucas and Scott Moore. Now, you don't know these guys because they suck. And the only thing they've directed is the sequel to this as well and some other crap you've never heard of.
Really, if you watch it, you would think Zack Snyder directed it.
Absolutely. Jesus Christ, those fucking needle drops in slow-mo are killer. But these guys stumbled ass backwards into success, I think. And they, unfortunately, were the writers of Four Christmases, the writers of Girlfriend's Past and A Change Up, but they were also somehow the writers of the Hangover movies. And I feel like they might have just been friends with Todd Phillips. And he was like, you know what? I'm the old school guy. And I'll take my credit for the first one. And maybe I'll give you guys an end credit for the writers, but you can write the others as like ghost writers. Like, I'm gonna write them, but you guys can have the money, like writing credits for that, because I guess they needed their writer's guild cards or something. But based on the gags that are in this, which if you watch this movie, you can tell are a lot of ad libs by Catherine Hahn and Kristen Bell. And even a little bit of
I normally like Catherine Hahn and Kristen Bell. I do not like them in this movie.
This, unfortunately, for 2016, this was when Catherine Hahn hadn't quite become like her own entity yet. She hadn't quite become Catherine Hahn. She was basically just a combination of, she was like a female version of Will Ferrell in Wedding Crashers with like a bit of a Vince Vaughn in Wedding Crashers feel, but with more of like a Ken Jeong, James Franco, Seth Rogen kind of wild cardness. But she was basically just put there to be like the brassy, crazy bitch. And she's the sloppy, can't get it together mom, or like the quote unquote, like party mom. And
yeah,
to Catherine Hunt's credit, she is a very funny woman. She is very funny. And most of her, a lot of her lines in this serve as funny one-liners. But when they're in the movie themselves, it's kind of like, okay, you just kind of said that because we needed a joke here. You know, it had been 30 seconds
without
a joke.
How many times do they just repeat things over and over again until they're like, hey, is this phrase funny yet? Is it funny yet?
Yeah, that's the other problem. And this, Kristen Bell is, if you watched, I love her in The Good Place. She is absolutely hilarious in The Good Place. But then again, that's also a show with very good writers. And she's funny. She can be very funny. And forgetting Sarah Marshall, she's fine. But she's usually very funny in a lot of things that she's in. And in this, she has some good one-liners. Because her character, Kiki, is this like stay-at-home homeschool mom who is basically married to the ultra finance bro stereotype. Like, no, you're the mother, you stay at home, I'm not being a father, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, all right, whatever. But her
still
one-liner,
not the worst father in the show with Mila Kunis's husband, which,
right, who is one of my least favorite stereotype characters in a rom-com, which is the, and it's the recent rom-com, the man-child husband, where the guy that just for some reason can't seem to be an adult. You know, he just can't figure it out. This guy's got an adult job. He's got an adult life. He clearly lives in the Chicago suburbs, very affluent suburbs. But he just
apparently fully remote job in 2016.
Right. He can't not be just a college guy. He just can't be like, oh, this marriage, it's, you know, it's cramping my style and blah, 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 and these kids and blah. But it's like, look, I usually like that actor and other things. He's played bit characters and other shit, and he's usually funny. But in this, it's like, come on, dude. Like, you have to know what character you're playing. And you should have been like, you know what? Paycheck time. I'm doing this for the paycheck. I'm a half-ass like everybody else in this movie, and we're just going to go. But this movie has two big things wrong with it. One is the overall feel that this is kind of like a feature-length version of one of those annoying, Mike, you're probably a little too young for this, but one of those annoying girls you went to high school with that are now stay-at-home moms, and all they can do is post Facebook memes about mommy needs wine and shit like that. Like, that's kind of the feature-length version. That's what this movie is. It's the feature-length movie version of posts like that. The other problem I have with this movie is the fact that Jada fucking Pinkett Smith is in this goddamn movie, and she's allegedly a decent human being. Except for the fact she's a bitch, but she's like a mom and married. And the problem that really shows its head is at the very end of this movie, when they're over the end credits, which Christina Applegate's mom might be my favorite mom in the history of the world. And then Jada Pinkett Smith's mom is there. Now, obviously, you can just put in J.A. into Google and Jada Pinkett Smith's name is going to come up, and all of the bullshit she's pulled in over the last 6 months alone, that's going to come up. She is a terrible woman. She is an awful wife. She is an awful human being. And that, to listen to them in this movie talk at the end of this, it's as if she's the greatest thing that's ever happened in the history of motherhood. And we know that that is complete fucking bullshit because of everything that she's done in the last 2 weeks. You know? Oh, and this was all taking place at the same time this movie was being made.
They have seen Applegate who's planting drugs on kids and or in kids' lockers and blackmailing the fucking soccer coach, J.J. Watt.
Played by J football player, J.J. Watt. But yeah, and that's the other thing. That's the thing. Before we get into the positive thing I have about Christina Applegate's mother, the thing with Christina Applegate's character, Gwendolyn, She is the head of the PTA and apparently the most powerful woman in the Chicago suburbs. And I am sorry. I am the son of a teacher. I am the son of was a very tenured teacher. This woman was very involved with all things related to teachers. She knew the ins and outs of everything. There isn't a single person on the PTA that has ever had the power that Christina Applegate has. Ever. The way to fix this character is to not have her be the head of a PTA. It's to have her be a mom. Yeah, not even, well, I wouldn't even do that. Because this is Chicago suburbs. These schools still suck. Now, I'm saying that she should have been the head of a homeowners association. And yeah. She should have been a mom through that. Because those people can legitimately terrorize you. And they will make your life a living hell.
The worst.
Yeah, they will legitimately make your life a living hell. And so for her to be the head of the PTA, it's like, okay, this is like Mean Girls, but with women who are about to go through menopause. And it's stupid. The way the daughter reacts to Mila Kunis after she finds out that the drugs are placed at the school, whatever. When Mila Kunis' daughter unloads on her and calls her a bad mom and says the father's a bad father and all that. Hey, I don't care if we're in front of a school full of your peers. I'm slapping the fuck out of you in front of that school if you ever talk to me that way as my daughter. And B, it's not even factually accurate, the shit that she says. And that's one of the things I really hate about this movie. It's that kid has to do that because she has to be an over-the-top conflict generator for this movie. And if there is a kid that exists like her with the anxiety that she has, that kid needs to be heavily medicated and studied by medical professionals. She is a problem, and a mental breakdown is coming very soon. But the funniest thing about this movie comes at the very end, and it is when Christina Applegate's actual mother is talking to her over the credits, and you find out that as a child, I'm talking child, Christina Applegate's mother took her daughter, Christina Applegate, to see the movie Cruising with Al Pacino for the sole reason that Al Pacino was the star of the movie. She didn't bother to look into what the actual movie was about. She just saw Al Pacino movie and took her child to see it.
God, I wasn't ready to see that movie when I was 26.
Right, we recently talked about that movie. It is a tough movie to get through as an adult. Like, can you imagine sitting in that theater and be like, is that a 10-year-old? Is there a 10-year-old next to me? I know this is 1970, whatever. But like, even now, we have some standards.
When I saw that, I was like, fuck. I wasn't mentally prepared for that movie as an adult.
Imagine being a child. And it's funny because even like Christina Applegate even says, like, she gives a summary of the movie itself. And it's like, wow, none of that is good for a kid. None of it. And you could take separate individual parts of that plot, make it solely the plot, and it still would not be appropriate for a child. No. But
man, you can tell with this movie, they were trying to like recreate comedy that they used in The Hangover. But there's a couple huge flaws with that. A, mom's deciding to just start drinking and going out and doing bad shit. Very different than guys getting drugged and hammered and going out and completely forgetting everything they did.
At a bachelor party. One specific weekend. Yeah. Not as a part of their new lifestyle.
Yeah. I'm like, all right, yeah. That's, if they decide to start taking roofies and bouncing back, so I think that Jaeger or something on the roof.
Yeah, anything. But yeah.
Yeah, so that, like, just the whole concept falls flat there for me because it's like, oh, you're tired of your life, so you're gonna get drunk and go trash a grocery store, and that's what we're doing. What grocery store has a suit of knight armor, by the way? I would like to know because I'd like to purchase some.
You know, the Chicago suburbs, man, they're apparently all over the place, you know. And yeah, it's just again. Like, it, and it'll be fine if that night, which it does, it legitimately does lead Mila Kunis to be like, to like chill out as a mom, yeah, basically. And that's fine. And she's also going through the fact that her husband was cheating on her night with what he says is a dairy farmer, when it's just a, fuck, I'm sure just a naked cam girl, you know, he's jerking off for. But yeah, so her life is kind of spiraling. But
Wanda Sykes is the fucking wedding counselor.
Right. Yeah, the couples counselor. Wanda Sykes is basically like, yeah, your marriage is unsavable. You know, you guys should definitely get a divorce. But
which is wild. Like, she's a terrible counselor, because really, you look at their session and you go, yeah, they're definitely not compatible, but God damn, I feel like counselors have helped people work through more than that.
Right. Right. I mean, and I mean, I was willing to look past that because A, it is Wanda Sykes and she's funny, and B, it is a small comedy. So yeah, you need to kind of have that line in there. But yeah, I think a real professional would be like, okay, we can do something with this, you know, even though granted, both of you have declared you want a divorce, probably still workable, or at least we can find a way to make this an amicable divorce, you know, and like, so it, the kids are good, but at least, and that's the thing, at least they do play that post like mutual divorce situation for it being a mutual divorce. Like, they are at least saying that there won't be a conflict between these two because they both do not want to be part of this marriage, but he still wants to be a dad. Like, there is that. It's like, okay, I at least get that. Did they recognize their relationship sucks, but they still need, the kids still need them in their lives. That's fine, whatever. But then again, we're dealing with the head of the PTA. This is not a villain. This woman is sad, and everyone should be recognizing that. This movie isn't set in the 80s, where people were just cheap and could care less. This is set in 2016. Facebook exists. This woman would definitely have the reputation of being a raging psychopath. There is the fact that she has these school board, like this school, like school administrators and coaches under her thumb, is a big problem, because that means that these people are completely spineless. And the fact that Bunk from The Wire is like, no, this woman scares me. No, he'd be like, I am the principal of a suburban Chicago school. I'm probably like Tim Meadows and Mean Girls. I didn't leave the South Side for this shit. Like, she definitely has seen worse than Gwendolyn, whatever the fuck. So he is definitely recognizing the fact that if there is a good student, which Mila Kunis's kid absolutely is, there's no way she is any kind of a troublemaker. If for some reason suddenly joints show up in her locker randomly after an anonymous tip from the biggest pain in your ass in the entire neighborhood and town, you would not just go, you know what, this kid clearly needs to be thrown off the team, all of that, because these drugs are definitely hers. This is not some weird plot by Gwendolyn. It's absolutely a normal thing that's happening right now. Like, no one has common sense in this movie, which, I granted, it's a rom-com, so common sense goes out the fucking window when we
begin. But literally nothing seems to happen naturally.
No, it's all contrived. It is all bullshit. It is all for the sake of the one-liner joke and the moving the plot forward, which, to this movie's credit, is only an hour and 40 minutes long, and it moves. I'll give it that. It doesn't ever drag.
Is fine in it.
He's fine. Yeah, and the movie doesn't drag, so at least there's that. You don't feel like you're going to die before the movie ends. But then when the turn happens, and we find out that Mila Kunis has been elected to the, she's the new PTA president, the reign of terror is over, we are then seen Christine Applegate's character, Gwendolyn, is crying in her Land Rover to I Want to Know What Love Is or whatever. And it turns out that her life is not as perfect as she plays it to be. What a fucking shock. But the first thing she says is, my husband was just discovered to be embezzling from a children's charity. Right there. She is clearly one of the richest women in the suburbs of Chicago. That is probably more than likely because of her husband's job at whatever the fuck he's doing. And then There is no possible way that even if she had kept the PTA presidency, there is no possible way she is ever able to do anything because the feds will be investigating her. She is going to be under a full-blown investigation that will explode her entire private life, her entire public life, her family, her reputation. Her entire life will be ruined because of the actions of her husband, let alone the fact that she will not have a fucking Learjet the end of this movie to just go on a joyride with these moms with. Everything will become property of the feds. All of this stuff. Her life will be over. The only thing she'll be able to do is kill herself. There is nothing left for her life. She will not become a good guy. She will not become friends with these people after this. She will be murdering herself by driving that Land Rover off of whatever bridge she can find. That's the only positive outcome for her after that bombshell is dropped. But no, we find out that, oh, that's just part of, a difficult part of being a mom. And it's like, no, that's
no, a most step moms don't have to far. Deal with a husband doing embezzling and like that. It's like you're not quite on Skylar from Breaking Bad levels of dealing with your husband's bullshit, but you're close.
Right. You're definitely not just, you know, you're not just living your life after that. It's not fucking happening. And the fact that our villains in this movie do not even have the basic story structure of getting what's coming to them. There is no comeuppance for these women. The worst thing that happens is Gwendolyn loses being PTA president. And she loses her influence over this fucking town. She was their dictator, essentially. She owned this town by sheer just being a rich white woman. And
it almost reminded me of the time Roger, an American Dad, took over as the homeowner association president.
I think
that's like he's like going around the neighborhood, he's putting like a fire hydrant right next to people's driveways so he can tow their cars and stuff.
Yeah. Again, that's the shit we're supposed to believe that this Gwendolyn is doing. But even with that, Jaden character, again, very fictional because he's apparently a human being. Who just had a mean girl phase. She's apparently living a good life after this. She's allowed to relax as a mom because Mila's new relax mom speech just makes everyone just kind of chill out. And they just take it easy from now on.
The love interest has like 3 minutes of screen time.
You mean Jay Hernandez, whose entire career will be characters like this going forward? Because of the Suicide Squad, which came out the same year?
But, 3 minutes of screen time. Three.
Yeah. And it's Jay Hernandez. I usually enjoy that guy and stuff. He's usually pretty good in things. And he can be funny. He can be good. He's funny with the lines he gets in this, at least. But what with this movie, aside from all that bullshit, the fact that it seems to be written by a white suburban mom Facebook page, there are couple decent one-liners in this movie. And I will say the one setup it's a very good setup. Like Mila Kunis is depressed. She's not going to go to the PTA president election. She's laying on her couch watching a movie. And the movie that you hear is just kind of like somebody getting whipped and kind of screaming. And she says, man, this movie's fucking depressing. Well, then Catherine Hahn and Kristen Bell come in. They're trying to rile her up and get all this like rah-rah going. We got to go take down Gwendolyn. And Catherine Hahn says, and what you're going to do is you're going to get up, you're going to stop watching 12 Years a Slave, and you're going to get out the store. And I was like, okay, that's a good setup right there. But it turns out she was watching 12 Years a Slave. It's like, yeah, that is a fucking depressing movie, Mila. But then there's the line that Gwendolyn has when she yells, and when Mila Kunis is like, you're going down. She yells, the only thing going down is your husband on another woman. It's like, okay, hey, great line right there. That's a great comeback. But then Jada Pinkett Smith says, well, damn. It's like, okay, Jada, hon, you don't get to say that line. You ain't the one that gets to comment on the line about a woman's husband cheating on her. That ain't you, bitch. Like, we all know that ain't you.
We gotta talk about a line that couldn't have aged worse with recent events in the Middle East.
Which one was that?
I'm pretty sure my brother-in-law just joined ISIS and is Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and at the same time, that's like a Mad Libs ad lib line. It's like fill in hot button political topic and the opposite of that to get punchline. And yeah, it is unfortunate that that doesn't hold up nowadays. But then again, it's the problem of doing like ad lib comedy for most of your movie. Granted, you got to utilize your great comedic actresses that you have, and they'll probably come up with something better than what you've written anyway. Problem is, it'll more than likely be topical and age like no, you know? But
Martha Stewart also shows up.
Martha Stewart's there because she's Martha Stewart, yeah. But did you see who this was originally going to be done by?
No.
This was originally supposed to star Leslie Mann and be a Judd Apatow production. This would have been a 3-hour fucking movie that would have been the story of Leslie Mann's character from Knock Up. That's all it would have been. And it would have been so much worse. So much worse. I mean, I'm not saying Leslie Mann can't be funny. She is a very funny actress. But when she's in her husband's movies and has to play a wife who's had it, we've seen that role. It's in Knocked Up and it's awful. And it's just, I mean, Kristen Bell does have a good one-liner when they're all trying to like admit shit about their kids. And she says her daughter about her daughter. She's like, Claire killed our neighbor's ferret. Played it off like it was an accident, but I know it wasn't. She's a killer. I was like, wow. Yeah, homeschool kid, that checks. That checks out.
Yeah, and I do love her, like, kind of deadpan delivery.
Yeah, Kristen Bell is very good at that delivery. The only thing is, though, and it's I watched the gag reel because Sarah has this on Blu-ray. The gag reel does have a little bit longer version of the uncircumcised dick scene where they're discussing in the makeup mirror what to do if Mila Kunis encounters an uncircumcised dick when she's trying to get laid that night. And Kristen Bell has a hoodie on. So Catherine Hahn pulls the hood up over it and she's like peeling it back slowly, making one-liners and all that. And the look on Kristen Bell's face is great because she's basically just like deadpan the whole time. So she's like kind of be like pretending to be a dick. It's kind of fun. But it's one of those lines where it's like you could tell that they just let Catherine Hahn go. And it was like, look, just go. We'll chop it down if we need to. There's more in the gag reel. Kind of funny, but still, it's like, okay, eventually this joke has to end, right? And it's like, are we sure Judd Apatow didn't produce this or at least edit it? Because this one goes on way too fucking long. This could have been an hour and 35 instead of an hour and 40, you know? But yeah, it's like, I can't. And again, and it's because I'm dead inside. The only thing that lands with me are the sick one-liners. And I was like, I fucking hate this movie. I just fucking hate it. I can't. Stand it, Mike. I can't sanction this buffoonery. So that's the end of week 3 of Round Kong Roulette. Mike, before we discuss the 3 movies, well, 2 that will make me go on a killing spree, where can people find us on the internet?
For your streaming pleasure, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, and just about anywhere else you get your podcast from. Thanks to Spotify Podcast. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at Happy Hour Films Podcast.
Nice. All right. So we have one more week of this rom-com roulette. Now my wife has chosen 2 absolute problems when it comes to rom-coms. And they both star the most hated woman in my life, Julia Roberts. First of which is My Best Friend's Wedding. Second of which is Pretty Woman. And then the good one will be Young Man, Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's going to be fun. And Mike, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, because your video is paused. I thought I lost it. I thought I was talking to nobody. But so we have Kindergarten Cop as our good movie that we're gonna do, and I don't know. I don't think Arnold, as powerful as he is, and in such a great, what's that?
Can save this week. I don't know if he can.
Yeah, I don't think he can do it. I don't think he can do it because Julia Roberts, that fucking large mouth Billy Bass. Fuck that woman. She's just too powerful for this week. And it might just be like an hour of me screaming with Mike trying to talk in between me taking breaths. That might just be it.
So this
right. That's all it's gonna be. That's all it's gonna be. So until next week when we discuss those god awful Julia Roberts pieces of shit. I have been Ross Bacon.
I've been Mike McGuigan.
We'll see you guys next time. So long.